Half an hour later, the faithful departed. Adamant and company were back in the study again. Adamant had visitors. Garrett Walpole and Lucian Sykes were businessmen, so successful that even Hawk and Fisher had heard of them. Their families were as old as Haven, and if their money hadn't come from trade, they could both have been leading members of the Quality. As it was, the lowest member of high society wouldn't have deigned to so much as sneer in their direction. Tradesmen used the back door, no matter how wealthy they were. Which was at least partly why Walpole and Sykes had come visiting. Not that they would ever have admitted it, of course.
Welcome, gentlemen.
They shook hands formally with Adamant and nodded generally around them as Adamant made the introductions.
Your advisor can stay, but the others will have to leave. Our business here is confidential, Adamant.
We're bodyguards. We stay with Sir Adamant.
Amused, Walpole looked at Hawk and Fisher.
Call off your dogs, will you, James? Perhaps your wife could take them to the kitchens for a cup of tea or something until our business is finished.
Don't care much for tea. We'll stay.
You'll do as you're damn well told. Now get out and don't come back till we call you. Adamant, tell them.
Hawk smiled slowly, and Sykes paled suddenly as his breath caught in his throat. Without moving a muscle, a change had come over Hawk. He suddenly looked dangerous. The scarred face was cold and impassive, and Sykes couldn't help noticing how Hawk's hand rested on the axe at his side. The room suddenly seemed very small, with nowhere to turn.
We're bodyguards. We stay.
Gentlemen, please. There's no need for any unpleasantness. We're all friends here. Hawk, Fisher, these gentlemen are my guests. I would be obliged if you would show them every courtesy while they're in my house.
Of course.
Though his tone was impeccably polite, the gaze from his single dark eye shone disturbingly cold. Sykes looked at Fisher, but if anything, her smile was even more disturbing.
There's no cause for alarm, my friends. My bodyguards fully understand our need for confidentiality. You have my word that nothing discussed here will go beyond the walls of this room.
Walpole looked at Sykes, who nodded grudgingly. Hawk smiled. Fisher leaned against the mantelpiece and folded her arms.
But your wife will still have to leave. This is not women's business.
Danielle flushed angrily and looked to Adamant for support, but he was already nodding slowly.
Very well, Lucian. If you insist. Denny, if you wouldn't mind.
Danielle shot him a quick look of betrayal and then gathered her composure sufficiently to smile graciously around the room before leaving. Although she didn't slam the door behind her, it felt as though she had. Adamant gestured for Walpole and Sykes to be seated and waited patiently for them to settle themselves comfortably before pouring them wine from the most delicately fashioned decanter. Hawk and Fisher held out their glasses for a refill. Adamant handed them the decanter and pulled up a chair opposite his visitors. The two guards remained standing. Hawk studied the two businessmen surreptitiously over his wine glass. He didn't move in their circle, but he knew them both by reputation. Guards made it their business to know the movers and shakers of Haven's community by sight. You could avoid a lot of embarrassment that way. Garrett Walpole was a bluff military type in his late 50s. He'd spent 20 years in the Low Kingdom's army before retiring to take over the family business, and it showed. He still wore his hair in a regulation military cut, and his back was as straight as a sword blade. He wore sober clothes of a conservative cut, and sat back in his chair as though he owned the place. Lucian Sykes was an overweight, ruddy-faced man in his late 40s. He wore the latest fashion with more determination than style, and looked more than a little uneasy in present company. Sykes was big in the import-export business, which was why he'd come to Adamant. The Dock Workers Guild was in the second week of its strike, and nothing was moving in or out of the docks. The conservative-backed DeWitt brothers were trying to break the strike with black-leg zombie workers, but so far that hadn't worked out too well. Zombies needed a lot of supervision and weren't what you'd call efficient workers. As it was, the Dock Workers Guild had more reason than usual to be mad at the conservatives and lined up firmly behind the reformers. If Sykes wanted to get his ships in or out of the docks anytime soon, he was going to need help from the right people. Reform people. Hawk grinned. He might be new to politics, but he knew a few things.
Well, what exactly can I do for you, my friends? Normally, I'd be only too happy to sit and chat for a while, but I have an election to fight and very little time to do it in. If you'll just tell me what you want, I'll be happy to tell you what it will cost you.
Walpole raised a sardonic eyebrow.
Plain speaking may be a virtue, James, but if I were you, I'd keep it to myself. There's no room for it in politics or business.
You should know.
Ha! James, I can't say I'm hopeful of your chances, because I'm not. High Steps has been a safe conservative seat for more than 30 years. All right, Hardcastle is a bit of a rotter, but people will vote for the devil they're familiar with, rather than a cause they don't know.
Even though the devil has bled them dry for years, and the cause will fight on their behalf? Or perhaps you don't believe in reform?
My dear chap, it has no hope.
Walpole took a cigar out of his pocket, looked at it wistfully, and put it away.
Only allowed one a day. Doctor's orders. I'd get another doctor, but he's the wife's brother. James, reform is a nice idea, but that's all. These fashions come and go, but they never last long. Too many vested interests concerned for to get anywhere.
Is that why you came here? To tell us we can't win?
Not at all. You asked me for money, James, and I'm here to give it to you. Who knows? You might win after all. And it wouldn't do me any harm to have you owe me a favor. Besides, I've been a friend of your family for most of my life. Fought beside your father in the Broken Ridges campaign. He was a good sort. I'm more than comfortably well off these days, and I can afford to throw away a few thousand ducats.
Walpole took a banker's draft from his pocket and handed it to Medley.
Put it to good use, James, and let me know if you need some more. And after this nonsense is over, do come and see me. I'm sure I can put some business your way. Now, I really must be going. Things to do, you know?
Walpole rose and stretched unobtrusively as Adamant got up and rang for the butler to see him out. Medley tucked the banker's draft safely away in his wallet before getting to his feet.
Good luck in the election, James. Good evening, gentlemen.
Walpole shook hands all around, and the butler escorted him out of the room. After Walpole's departure, the room became suddenly very quiet. Adamant and Medley sat down again and turned their attention to Lucian Sykes. The businessman glanced quickly at the two guards, scowled unhappily, and then leaned forward to face Adamant.
You know my position. I have to get my ships in and out of the docks soon, or I stand to lose every penny I've got. You know I've donated money to the cause in the past. I've been one of your main backers. Now I need your help. I need your word that the first thing you'll do as a counselor is to put pressure on those bastards in the Dock Workers Guild to call off their strike. For a while, at least.
I'm afraid I can't do that. But I could put some pressure on the DeWitt brothers to be more reasonable. After all, they caused the strike by refusing to spend the money needed to make the docks a safe place to work.
That won't do any good. I've already talked to Marcus and David DeWitt. They don't give a damn for anyone but themselves. It's become a matter of principle to them not to give in to their workers. If they want to dig their own financial grave, that's up to them. But I'm damned if I'm going to let them drag me down with them.
You could always go to Hardcastle.
I tried. He wouldn't see me. 3,000 ducats, Adamant. That's my offer. I've got the bank draft right here.
I'll talk to the guild and put what pressure I can on the DeWitts. That's all I can promise you. If that's not good enough, then we'll have to do without your money.
Sykes took a folded bank draft out of his coat pocket, hefted it in his hand, and then tossed it onto the desk.
I'll see you again, Adamant. If you win the election.
He pulled his coat around him, glared briefly at Hawk and Fisher, and left the study. Hawk turned slightly to look at Adamant.
Is it normally this blatant? I mean, when you get right down to it, those two were giving you bribes in return for future favors. Reform's always campaigned against that kind of corruption in the past.
Fighting an election costs money. Lots of it. James couldn't hope to pay all the bills on his own, and the cause can't do much to help. What money they have has to be spread around among the poorer candidates. All they could give us was this house. So we take the funds where we can find them. You can bet Hardcastle isn't bothered by any such niceties. If his supporters don't make big enough donations, all he has to do is threaten to raise property taxes. And it's not as if we promise to do anything against our principles. In the end, all politics is based on people doing favors for each other. That's what keeps the system going. It may not be a pretty system, but then that's one of the things we are fighting to change.
The door flew open. Danielle swept in. She glared at them all impartially and then sank into her favorite chair.
I feel like I ought to open all the windows and set up incense sticks just to get the smell of politics out of this room.
Sorry, Denny, but they really wouldn't have talked freely with you there, and we needed the money they were offering.
Let's change the subject.
Is there anything more you need to know before we start campaigning, Captain Hawk? Captain Fisher?
Yes. I need more information on the other candidates. Hardcastle, for example. I gather he's unpopular, even among his own people.
The man's a brute. He runs the high steps like his own private barony. Even levies his own separate tax, though it's not called that, of course. It's an insurance policy. People who don't or can't keep up their payments find their luck suddenly changed for the worse. It starts with beatings, moves on to fires, and ends with murder. And no one says anything. Even the guard looks the other way.
We're the guard here now. Tell me about Hardcastle himself.
He's a thug and a bully, and his word is worthless. He takes bribes from everyone, and then welches on the deal, as often as not. He's been very successful in business, and it's rumored he knows where some very important bodies are buried. He has his own little army of men-at-arms and hired bullies. Anyone who tries to speak out against him gets their legs broken as a warning. I don't think he has any friends, but he has acquaintances in high places.
Anything else?
He's married, but I've never met her.
Not many have. She doesn't go out much. From what I hear, it was an arranged marriage for business reasons. They've been married 7 years now. No children.
An army of men-at-arms. You mean mercenaries?
That's right. It's hard to get an accurate figure, but he's got at least 300 men under his personal command, probably more.
And this is the man you're standing against? You must be crazy. You're going to need your own private army just to walk the streets in safety.
What do I need an army for? I've got you and Captain Hawk, haven't I? Relax, Captain Fisher. We have our own mercenaries. Not as many as Hardcastle, but enough. They'll keep the worst elements off our backs. We'll just have to play the rest by ear.
Terrific.
Tell me about the other candidates.
Adamant looked at Medley, who frowned thoughtfully before speaking.
Well, first there's Lord Arthur Sinclair, a youngish chap. Inherited the title a few years back under rather dubious circumstances, but that's nothing new in Haven. Plays politics for the fun of it as much as anything. Likes all the attention and the chance to stand up in public and make a fool of himself. He's standing as an independent because nobody else would have him, and he wants to see an end to all forms of tax on alcohol. He has some backing, mostly from beer, wine, and spirits industries. He's wealthy enough to buy himself a few votes, but the only way he'll get elected is if all the other candidates drop dead, and even then there'd have to be a recount.
He means well, but he's no danger to anyone except himself. He drinks like a fish, from what I've heard.
And then there's Megan O'Brien. He's a spice merchant, also independent, standing for free trade. Given that a great deal of Haven's income comes from the very taxes O'Brien wants stopped, I don't think much of his chances. He'd be lucky to get through the election without being assassinated. And of course there's General Longarm, once part of the Low Kingdom's army, and now a part of a militant movement within the Brotherhood of Steel. He's been officially disowned by the Brotherhood, though whether that means anything is open to question. The Brotherhood's always been devious. Longarm's campaigning as an independent, on the law and order ticket. Believes every lawbreaker should be beheaded, on the spot, and wants compulsory military service introduced for every male over 14. He's crazier than a brewery rat, and about as charismatic. His Brotherhood connections might get him a few votes, but otherwise he's harmless.
I wouldn't count him out completely. Brotherhood militants took the downs away from the Conservatives at the last election. I think it would be wise to keep a good weather eye on General Longarm.
Any more candidates?
Fisher helped herself to more wine from the nearest decanter.
Just one. A mystery candidate. A sorcerer called the Grey Veil. No one's seen or heard anything about him, but his name is on the official list. Magicians aren't actually banned from standing in the election, but the rules against using magic are so strictly enforced, most magic users don't bother. They say they're unfairly discriminated against, and they may well be right. Mortis says he's never even heard of the Grey Veil, so he can't be that powerful.
We had a run-in with a sorcerer earlier today. It might have been him.
Doesn't make any difference. We ran him off. If he was the Grey Veil, I think we can safely assume he's no longer standing. Running, maybe, but not standing. The report we filed will see to that.
Let me get this straight. Apart from us, there's Hardcastle and his mercenaries, militant Brothers of Steel, and a handful of independents with whatever bullies and bravos they can afford. Adamant, this isn't just an election, it's an armed conflict. I've known battles that were safer than this sounds like it's going to be.
Now you're getting the hang of it.
I think that's covered everything. Now, would anyone like a quick snack before we leave? I doubt we'll have time to stop to eat once we've started.
Hawk looked hopefully at Fisher, but she shook her head firmly.
Apparently we're fine. Thanks anyway.
It's no trouble. It'll only take a minute to send word to the kitchen staff and the food taster.
Food taster?
People are always trying to poison me. Reform has a lot of enemies in Haven, and particularly in the High Steps. Mortis sees to it that none of the attempts get past the kitchens, so the food taster's really only there as a backup. Even so, you wouldn't believe what he's costing me in danger money.
I don't think we'll bother with the snack.
Fisher gave the wine at the bottom of her glass a hard look.
You stick with us, Hawk. We'll give you a solid grounding on politics in Haven. There's a lot more to it than meets the eye.
So I'm finding out.
Brimstone Hall stood aloof and alone in the middle of its grounds, surrounded by a high stone wall emblazoned with protective runes. Armed men watched from behind the massive iron gates, and guard dogs patrolled the wide-open grounds. Rumor had it the dogs had been fed human meat just long enough to give them a taste for it. There used to be apple trees on the grounds. Hardcastle had ordered them torn up by the roots. They offered shelter to potential assassins. A very careful man, Cameron Hardcastle trusted nothing and no one with good cause. He had destroyed many men in his time, one way or another, and helped to ruin many more. It was said he had more enemies than any other man in Haven. Hardcastle believed it, and took pride in the fact. In a city of harsh and ruthless men, he had made himself a legend. Constant death threats were a small price to pay. The hall itself was a crumbling stone monstrosity held together by ancient spells and never-ending repair work. It was stiflingly hot in the summer and impossible to heat in the winter, but it had been home to the Hardcastles for years past counting, and Cameron would not give it up. Hardcastles never gave up anything that was theirs. They were supposed to have been instrumental in the founding of Haven, which might have been why so many of them had been convinced they should be running it. Cameron Hardcastle began his career in the Low Kingdom's army. It was expected of him, his class, and his family, and he hated every minute of it. He left the army after only 7 years, retiring in haste before he could be court-martialed. It was said the charges would have been extreme cruelty, but no one took that seriously. Extreme cruelty was usually what got you ahead in the Low Kingdom's army. The men fought so well because they were more afraid of their officers than they were of the enemy. More importantly, there were rumors of blood sacrifice behind locked doors in the officers' mess. But no one talked about that. It wasn't considered healthy. Hardcastle himself was an average height, stocky man, with a barrel chest and heavily muscled upper arms. He was good-looking in a rough, scowling way, with a shock of dark hair and an unevenly trimmed mustache. He was in his mid-40s, and looked it. But you only had to meet him for a few moments to feel the strength and power that radiated from him. Whatever else people said about him, and there was a lot of talk, most of it unpleasant, they all admitted the man had presence. When he entered a crowded room, the room fell silent. He had a loud, booming laugh, though his sense of humor wasn't very pleasant. Most people went to the theater for their entertainment. Hardcastle's idea of a good time was a visit to the public hangings. He enjoyed bear baiting, prize fights, and kept a half dozen dogs to go ratting with. On a good day, he'd nail the rat's tails to the back door to show his tally. He was conservative because his family always had been, and because it suited his business interests to be so. The Hardcastles were of aristocratic stock, and no one was allowed to forget it. Of late, most of their money came from rents and banking, but no one was foolish enough to treat Hardcastle as a merchant or a businessman. Even as a joke, to do so would be to risk an unhappy future. When he thought about politics at all, which wasn't often, Hardcastle believed in everyone knowing their place and keeping to it. He thought universal suffrage was a ghastly mistake, and one he fully intended to rectify at the first opportunity. Reform was nothing more than a disease in the body politic, to be rooted out and destroyed, starting with James Adamant. Hardcastle sat in his favorite wing chair, staring out the great window in his study and scowling furiously. Adamant was going to be a problem. The man had a great deal of popular support, more than any previous reform candidate, and taking care of him was going to be difficult and expensive.
I hate spending money I don't have to. Fortunately, there are other alternatives.
The counselor turned his gaze away from the window and looked across at his sorcerer, Wolf. The sorcerer was a tall, broad-shouldered man with a fine, noble head that was just a little too large for his body. His thick auburn hair fell to his shoulders in a mass of curls and knots. His face was long and narrow and heavy-boned. His eyes were dark and thoughtful. He dressed always in sorcerer's black, complete with cape and cowl, and looked the part to perfection. Wolf was a newcomer to Haven, and as yet hadn't shown much evidence of his power, but no one doubted he had it. A few weeks back, four street thugs attacked him. It took the city guard almost a week to find a horse and cart sturdy enough to carry the four stone statues away. They ended up on the Street of Gods. Tourists burn incense sticks before them, but the statues are still silently screaming. In a chair in the corner, with head bowed and hands clasped neatly in her lap, sat a silent Jillian Hardcastle, Cameron's wife. She was barely into her mid-twenties, but she looked 20 years older. She had been pretty once, in an unremarkable way, but life with Hardcastle had worn her away until there was no character left in her face, only a shape, and features that faded from memory the moment she was out of sight. Jillian dressed in rich and fashionable clothes because her husband expected it of her, but she still looked like what she was, a poor little country mouse brought into the city and had every spark of individuality beaten out of her. Those who spent time in Hardcastle's company learned not to comment on the occasional bruises and black eyes that marked Jillian's face, or the morning she spent lying in bed, resting. They'd been married 7 years. It was an arranged marriage. Hardcastle arranged it. Hardcastle glared at Wolf for a long moment.
You told me your magics could break through any barrier adamant could buy. So why is he still alive?
He must have found himself a new sorcerer. I'm surprised anyone would work with him after what I did to his last magic user. But then, that's Haven for you. There's always someone if the money's right. It won't make any difference in the long run. It may take a little time to find just the right opening, but I doubt this magic user will be any more difficult to dispose of than the last one.
More delays. I don't like delays, Sorcerer. I don't like excuses, either. I want James Adamant dead and out of the way before the people vote. I don't care what it costs or what you have to do. I want him dead. Understand, Sorcerer?
Of course, Cameron. I assure you, there's no need to worry. I'll take care of everything. I trust the rest of your campaign is running smoothly?
So far, the posterers have been out since dawn, and my mercenaries have been dealing with Adamant's men quite successfully, in spite of the interfering guard. If Adamant is foolish enough to try and hold any street gatherings, my men will see they don't last long. Commoners don't have the guts to stand and fight. Spill some blood on the cobbles, and they'll scatter fast enough.
Quite right, Cameron. There's nothing at all to worry about. We thought of everything, planned for every eventuality. Nothing can go wrong.
Don't take me for a fool, Sorcerer. Something can always go wrong. Adamant's no fool either. He wouldn't still be investing so much time and money in his campaign if he didn't think he had a very good chance of beating me. He knows something, Wolf. Something we don't. I can feel it, Sorcerer. I don't like to feel it.
Of course not, Cameron. I'll make further inquiries. In the meantime, I have someone waiting to meet you.
I hadn't forgotten. Your chief of mercenaries. The one you've been so mysterious about. Very well. Who is it?
Wolf braced himself.
Roxanne.
Hardcastle sat up straight in his chair.
Roxanne! You brought that woman into my house? Get her out of here, now!
It's perfectly all right, Cameron. I brought two of my best men to keep an eye on her. I think you'll find her reputation is a little exaggerated. She's the best sword for hire I've ever come across. Unbeatable with a blade in her hand and a master strategist. She works well on her own or in charge of troops. She's done an excellent job for us so far, with remarkably few fatalities. She's a genuine phenomenon.
She's also crazy.
There is that, yes, but it doesn't get in the way of her work.
Hardcastle slowly settled back into his chair, but his scowl remained.
All right, I'll see her. Where is she?
in the library. At least there's not much there she can damage. Jillian, go and get her.
Jillian nodded silently, got to her feet, and left the study, being carefully to ease the door shut behind her so that it wouldn't slam. Hardcastle turned away from the window and stared at the portrait of his father hanging on the opposite wall, a dark and gloomy picture of a dark and gloomy man. Gideon Hardcastle hadn't been much of a father, and Cameron shed no tears at his funeral. But he had been a counselor in Haven for 34 years. Cameron Hardcastle was determined to do better. Being a counselor was just the beginning. He had plans. He was going to make the name Hardcastle respected and feared throughout the Low Kingdoms, whatever it took. Roxanne prowled restlessly back and forth in Hardcastle's library, her boots sinking soundlessly into the thick pile rug. The two mercenaries set to guard her watched nervously from the other side of the room. Roxanne smiled at them now and then, just to keep them on their toes. She was tall, 6'3", even without her boots, with a lithe, muscular body. She wore a shirt and trousers of bright lime yellow, topped with a battered leather jacket. She looked like a vicious canary. She wore a long sword on her left hip in a well-worn scabbard. At first sight, she was not unattractive. Roxanne was young, in her early 20s, with a sharp-boned face, blazing dark eyes, and a mass of curly black hair held in place with a leather headband. But there was something about Roxanne, something in her unwavering gaze and disturbing smile, that made even the most experienced mercenary uneasy. Besides, everyone knew her reputation. Roxanne first made a name for herself when she was 15, fighting as a sword for hire in the Silk Trail Vendettas. The rest of her company were wiped out in an ambush, and she had to fight her way back alone through the enemy lines. She killed 17 men and women that night, and had the ears to prove it. The people who saw her stride back into camp that night, laughing and singing, covered with other people's blood, and wearing a necklace of human ears, swore they'd never seen anything more frightening in their lives. She went through a dozen mercenary companies in less than 3 years, and despite her swordsmanship, they were always glad to see her go. She was brave and loyal as long as she was paid regularly, and always the first to lead an attack, but there was no getting away from the fact that Roxanne was stark, staring crazy. When there wasn't an enemy to fight, she'd pick quarrels among her own people, just to get a little action. She was even worse when she got drunk. People who knew her learned to recognize the signs early and head for the nearest exit. Roxanne had a nasty temper and a somewhat strange sense of humor. For her, a good night out tended to involve knife fights, terrorizing the locals, and burning down inns that expected her to pay her bar bills. Not that she limited her arson to inns. Quite often, she'd set fire to a tent or two in her own camp, for reasons that made sense only to her. Roxanne liked a good fire. She also liked betting everything she had on one roll of the dice and then refusing to pay up if she lost. She worshipped a god no one had ever heard of, had an entirely unhealthy regard for the truth, and picked fights with nuns. She said they offended her sense of the lightness of things. If Roxanne had a sense of the lightness of things, it was news to everyone who'd ever met her. Everyone agreed that Roxanne would go far, and the sooner the better. She ended up in Haven after a disagreement with a captain of the guard over the prices in a Jaspertown company store. When someone explained to her that she'd just killed the local mayor's son, she decided it might be time to start looking for new employment. So she threw the captain's head through the mayor's front window, set fire to a post office as a distraction, and headed for Haven as fast as her stolen horse could carry her. Roxanne roamed about Hardcastle's library, picking things up and putting them down again. She'd never seen so many resolutely ugly pieces of ornamental china in her life, and there wasn't a damn thing worth stealing. She broke a few ornaments on general principles, and because they made such a pleasant sound as they smashed against the stone wall. The two mercenaries stirred uneasily, but said nothing. Ostensibly, they were there to keep her out of trouble and make sure she didn't set fire to anything, but Roxanne knew they wouldn't do anything unless they absolutely had to. They were scared of her. Most people were, particularly when she smiled. Roxanne smiled widely at the two mercenaries. They both paled visibly, and she turned away, satisfied. She started to pace up and down again, tapping her fingertips on her sword belt. She never could stay still for long. She had too much energy in her. She looked around quickly as the library door swung open and then took her hand away from her sword as a pale, colorless woman came in. At first, Roxanne thought she must be a servant, but a quick glance at the quality of her clothes suggested that she had to be very upper class, even if she didn't act like it. She ignored the two mercenaries and addressed herself to Roxanne without raising her eyes from the floor.
My husband will see you now. Please follow me and I'll take you to him.
The two mercenaries looked at each other.
Pardon me, ma'am, but we're supposed to stay with her.
Gillian Hardcastle glanced at him briefly and then looked back at the floor.
My husband wants to see Roxanne. He didn't mention you.
The mercenary frowned uncertainly.
I don't really think
you
we should...
You stay put. Don't touch the booze and don't break anything. Got it?
Yeah, got it. We stay right here.
The other mercenary nodded quickly. Roxanne followed Gillian Hardcastle out of the library and into the long, wide hall. Roxanne did her best to look unimpressed. She quickly realized she needn't bother, as Gillian kept her gaze firmly on the ground at all times. Roxanne stared at her thoughtfully. This beaten-down little mouse was Hardcastle's wife? Perhaps the rumors about him were true after all. Gillian opened the study door and gestured politely for Roxanne to go in first. Roxanne entered swaggering, with her thumbs tucked into her sword belt. Hardcastle and Wolf got to their feet. Hardcastle studied her narrowly. Roxanne smiled at them both and didn't miss the look of unease that crossed their faces. She knew the effect her smile had on people. That was why she used it. She glanced quickly around the study. Not bad. Quite luxurious in its way. She did her best to look as though she'd seen better in her time.
Welcome to my house, Roxanne. Wolf tells me you've done good work for me. As a reward, I have a special assignment for you. You'll be working mostly alone, but there's an extra 500 ducats in it for you.
Sounds good. What's the catch?
Hardcastle frowned. Out of the corner of her eye, Roxanne saw Gillian wince momentarily, and then her face was blank and empty again. Roxanne dropped insolently into the most comfortable-looking chair and draped one leg over the padded arm. Hardcastle looked at her for a moment and then drew up a chair opposite her. Wolf and Gillian remained standing. Hardcastle met Roxanne's gaze for a moment and then looked away, despite himself.
James Adamant is standing against me in the election. I want him stopped. Hurt him, kill him, I don't care. Spend as much as you need, use whatever tactics you like. If there are any repercussions, I'll get you out of Haven in plenty of time.
The catch?
Adamant has two captains of the city guard as bodyguards. They're called Hawk and Fisher.
I've heard of them. They're supposed to be good. Very good. Hardcastle, I'd almost do this for free. Just for the chance to go up against those two.
They're not the target. If you have a grudge with them, you deal with it on your own time.
Of course.
Even apart from them, Adamant's going to be hard to reach. He has his own mercenaries and a new magic user. I understand you have a special contact of your own among his people, so I'll leave the details to you. But it has to be done soon.
Hardcastle picked up his wine glass.
Gillian, get me some wine.
She moved quickly forward, took the glass from his hand, and went over to the row of decanters on the nearby table.
Do I get any support on this? Or am I working entirely on my own?
Use whatever people you need, but make sure there are no direct links to me. Officially, you're just another of my mercenaries.
Gillian brought him a glass of wine. Hardcastle looked at it without touching it.
Gillian, what is this?
Your wine, Cameron.
What kind of wine?
Red wine.
And what kind of wine do I normally drink when I have guests?
White wine.
So why have you brought me red?
Gillian's mouth began to tremble slightly, though her face remained blank.
I don't know.
It's because you're stupid, isn't it?
Yes, Cameron.
Go and get me some white wine.
Gillian went back to the decanters. Hardcastle looked at Roxanne, who was studying him thoughtfully.
Have you got something to say, mercenary?
She's your wife.
Yes, she is.
Gillian came back with his white wine. Hardcastle took the glass and put it down on the desk without tasting it.
I'll talk with you about this later, Gillian.
She nodded and stood silently beside his chair. Her hands were clasped so tightly together that the knuckles showed white.
It's time for you to speak to your people, Cameron. We need them out on the streets as quickly as possible, and you need to speak to them before they go.
Hardcastle nodded ungraciously and got to his feet. He looked at Roxanne.
You'd better come too. You might learn something.
Wouldn't miss it.
The main foyer at Brimstone Hall was uncomfortably large. Two chandeliers of massed candles spread a great pool of light down the middle of the hall, and oil lamps lined the walls. Even so, deep shadows pressed close around the borders of the light. Silence lay heavily across the hall. Armed men stood at intervals along the walls, staring blankly straight ahead, somehow all the more menacing for their complete lack of movement. A wide set of stairs led up to a gallery overlooking the hall. Hardcastle stood at ease on the gallery, smiling faintly at some pleasant thought of things to come. Jillian stood at his side, quiet, pliant, head bowed, and eyes far away as though trying to pretend she wasn't really there at all. Roxanne stood back away, hidden in the shadows of the gallery. Wolf sat on a chair beside her, legs casually crossed, hands folded neatly in his lap. He might have been waiting for a late dessert or a promised glass of wine, but there was something unsettling in the air of anticipation that hung about him. Something unhealthy. Roxanne kept a careful watch on him from the corner of her eye. She didn't trust sorcerers. Not that she trusted anyone when you got right down to it, but in her experience, magic users were a particularly treacherous breed. Hardcastle finally nodded to the two armed mercenaries at the end of the hall. The men pulled back the bolts and swung open the massive main doors. The crowd of conservative supporters surged in, herded by polite but firm stewards. The crowd carried flags and banners, but it had to be said that they didn't exactly look enthusiastic to be there. Roxanne couldn't help but wonder whether the armed guards were there to keep people out or keep them in. As the main doors closed behind the last of the crowd, Hardcastle looked out over his supporters.
My friends, we gather on this historic night to embark on a mission. A mission to bring prosperity to every single citizen of Haven.
Roxanne was never really clear what the speech had been about. It was an excellent speech, no doubt of that, but she couldn't seem to sort out what exactly had been so enthralling about it. She only knew that the moment Hardcastle began to speak, he became magnetic. She couldn't tear her eyes away from him, and she strained to hear every word. The crowds below were besotted with him, cheering and applauding and waving their banners frantically every time he paused. Even the stewards and mercenaries seemed fascinated by him. Hardcastle looked out over the ecstatic crowd, smiling slightly, and then gestured for silence.
My friends, there is one among you who has proved himself worthy of my special attention. Joshua Steele, step forward.
There was a pause, and then a young man dressed in the gaudy finery of the minor quality made his way through the crowd to stand at the foot of the stairs. Even from the back of the gallery, Roxanne could tell he was scared. His hands had clenched into fists at his sides, and his face was deathly pale. Hardcastle's smile widened a little.
Steele, I set you a task. Nothing too difficult. All you had to do was use your contacts to find out whether James Adamant was still magically protected. You told me he wasn't. That's not true, is it, Steele?
The young man licked his lips quickly and shifted his weight from one foot to the other.
I did everything I could, Counselor! Honestly! His old sorcerer mask is dead, and Adamant hasn't made any move to replace him. My informants were very precise!
You lied to me, Steele. You betrayed me!
The crowd drew back from Steele in horror as he fell writhing to the floor. Blood spurted from his nose and ears, and then from his eyes. He clawed at his face, and then at his stomach as bloody spots appeared on his tunic. Small fanged mouths burst out of his flesh all over his body as hundreds of bloodworms chewed their way out of him. One of them ruptured the carotid artery in his neck, and blood flew out, soaking the nearest members of the crowd. Despite their revulsion, the crowd couldn't tear their eyes away. Steele kicked and struggled feebly for a few moments longer. His body continued to twitch and jerk as the bloodworms ate their way out. Some of the crowd stamped on the horrid things as they left the body, but it quickly became clear the worms were already dying. They couldn't survive for long once they left their host. Roxanne looked thoughtfully at Hardcastle's back, and then at the Sorcerer Wolf. There was a lesson here worth remembering. If she ever fell out with Hardcastle, she'd better make sure the Sorcerer was dead first. She looked back at the crowd. They were silent and shocked, sullen now. Their holiday mood was ruined.
My friends, we gather to bring prosperity to Haven.
And once more, his marvelous oratory worked its magic. In a matter of moments, the crowd was won over again, and soon they were stamping and cheering and shouting his name just as they had before. They seemed to have forgotten all about the dead man in their midst. Hardcastle filled their hearts and minds with good cheer and sent them out into the streets to campaign on his behalf. The crowd filed out of the hall, laughing and chattering animatedly among themselves. Soon, the hall was empty, apart from the stewards and the mercenaries. Hardcastle glanced down at the corpse lying below.
Have someone clean up the mess.
He turned and left the gallery, followed by Wolf and Jillian. Roxanne paused, looking at the torn and blood-soaked body lying alone in the middle of the floor. Hardcastle strode into his study and poured himself a large drink.
The speech went well, and that little bastard Steele got what was coming to him. Maybe there is some justice in the world after all.
He lowered himself into his favorite chair.
What now?
Hardcastle rose quickly from his chair, and his gaze went immediately to the family longsword hanging on the wall over the fireplace. He'd had a strong feeling he'd need the blade sooner or later during his campaign. With Wolf's war on Adamant's house finally beginning to warm up, it was only to be expected that Adamant would respond in kind.
Damn!
Hardcastle put down his glass and pulled the longsword from its sheath. So much for Adamant's puerile insistence on playing by the rules. There was only one rule in politics, and that was to win.
It's good to have sword in hand again. I've been too long in smoke-filled rooms, arguing with fools over what should be mine by right. All right, then, let them come. Let them all come. I'll show them again I'm a force to be reckoned with.
He shot a quick glance at Jillian, who stood uncertainly by the door, one hand raised to her mouth. He gestured curtly for her to get away from the door, and she fled to the nearest chair and stood behind it.
Hush, brothers, hush.
Wolf stayed by the door, making hurried gestures with his hands.
Well, what's out there? Are we under attack?
Not by magic, Cameron. My wards are still holding. The attack must be on the physical plane. Mercenaries, perhaps.
He stopped suddenly.
Can you smell smoke?
They looked at each other as the same thought struck them at the same time. They didn't need to say her name. Hardcastle threw open the door and hurried out into the hall, sword in hand, followed by Wolf. Roxanne had her back to the wall and her sword at the ready as she faced off against two of Hardcastle's mercenaries. She grinned broadly. The mercenaries looked scared but determined. A little further down the hall, a huge wall tapestry was going up in flames. Several servants were trying to put it out with pans and buckets of water. Hardcastle's face purpled dangerously.
Roxanne, what's the meaning of this?
Just having a little fun. I was doing all right until these two spoilsports interfered. I'll be with you in a minute, as soon as I've dealt with them.
Roxanne, these men belong to your employer, Counselor Hardcastle. They are under his protection.
Oh.
She sheathed her sword. The mercenaries put away their swords, looking more than a little relieved. Wolf gestured for them to leave, and they did so quickly, before he could change his mind. Wolf looked at Roxanne reproachfully.
When you signed the contract to work for Counselor Hardcastle, there was a specific clause stating that you wouldn't start any fires except those we asked you to.
You know I can't read.
I read it aloud to you.
It was an ugly tapestry anyway.
Very well. Well, that's as may be. But as long as you work for the Counselor, you will abide by your contract. Or are you saying your word is worthless?
Roxanne glared at him. Wolf's stomach lurched, but he stood his ground. He knew any number of spells that would stop her in her tracks, but he had a sneaking suspicion she'd still survive long enough to kill him, no matter what he did to her. Confronting her this early was a definite risk, but it had to be done. Either her word was binding, or it wasn't. If it wasn't, then she was too dangerous a weapon to be used. He'd have to let her go, and hope he could kill her safely from a distance. Roxanne scowled suddenly and leaned against the wall with her arms folded.
All right. No more fires. You people have no sense of fun.
Of course not. We're in politics.
If you've quite finished, perhaps you'd care to accompany me back to my study. I'm expecting some very important guests, and I want both of you present, if you can spare the time.
Of course. You're the boss.
Hardcastle gave her a hard look and then led the way back to his study. The DeWitt brothers were already there, waiting for him. With a look, Hardcastle silently promised his butler a slow and painful death for not warning him, and then smiled courteously at the DeWitts and walked forward to shake hands with them. At the last moment, he realized he was still holding his sword and handed it quickly to Wolf to replace on the wall. At least Jillian had had the sense to get the DeWitts a glass of white wine. Perhaps the situation could still be saved. Marcus and David DeWitt were both in their late 40s, and on first impression looked much the same. Tall, slender, elegant, and arrogant. Dark hair and eyes made their faces appear pale and washed out, giving their impassive features the look of a mummer's mask. A quiet, understated menace adorned their unwavering self-possession, as though nothing in the world would dare disturb them. They'd left their swords at the front door, along with their bodyguards, as a sign of trust. But Hardcastle wasn't fool enough to believe they were unarmed. The DeWitts had many enemies and took no chances, even with a supposed ally. Between them, Marcus and David DeWitt ran a third of the docks in Haven, on the age-old principle of the minimum investment for the maximum gain. Their docks were notorious for being the worst maintained, the most dangerous work areas in Haven. If the DeWitts cared about that, they hid it remarkably well. Life was cheap in Haven, and labor even cheaper. And the DeWitts' charges were attractively low, so they never wanted for traffic. But now the dock strike was crippling them, despite the zombie scab labor. The dead men were cheap enough to run and never got tired, but they weren't very bright and needed constant supervision. They were also easy targets for dock worker guerrilla units armed with salt and fire. A conservative-backed council would support the DeWitts against the Dock Workers Guild, even if it came down to open violence and intimidation. Reform would back the guild. So the DeWitts were making the rounds before the election, buying themselves counselors. Unfortunately for them, they needed Hardcastle more than he needed them. So if they wanted his support, they were going to have to pay through the nose for it. Wolf sat and leaned back in his chair, quietly studying the DeWitt brothers. They were an unpleasant pair by all accounts, but he'd worked with worse in his time, like Hardcastle, for example. A brute and a bully, and not nearly as clever as he thought he was. Wolf had done a great many unpleasant things himself down the years. His style of magic demanded it. But he did them in a business-like way, because they were necessary. Hardcastle did unpleasant things because he enjoyed it. He was one of those people who can only prove how important they are by showing how unimportant everyone else is. Wolf frowned slightly. Such men are dangerous to themselves and those around them. But for the moment, Hardcastle was a man with power, a rising star, a man on the way up. Wolf could go far riding the coattails of such a man. And when Hardcastle's star began to wane, Wolf would move on. He harbored ambitions of his own. Hardcastle was just a means to an end. Marcus DeWitt eyed Hardcastle.
20,000 ducats.
DeWitt took a folded bank draft from his coat pocket and laid it carefully on the table before him.
I trust that will be sufficient.
For the moment.
Hardcastle gestured easily to Wolf, who leaned forward and picked up the bank draft. David DeWitt opened a small silver snuff box and took out a pinch of white powder.
James Adamant has a hell of a lot of followers out on the streets.
He smiled and looked steadily at Hardcastle.
Just how do you intend to deal with this very popular reformer, Sir Hardcastle? The traditional way. Money and force of arms. The carrot and the stick. It never fails, providing it's applied properly. My people are already out on the streets.
Adamant has money. He also has Hawk and Fisher.
They're not infallible. They couldn't keep Blackstone from being killed. They caught his killer and made sure he didn't live to stand trial.
There's no need to worry. We have our own wild card. Gentlemen, may I present the legendary Roxanne?
She smiled at the DeWitt brothers, and they both flinched a little.
Yes. I thought I smelt something burning as we came in.
I always thought she'd be taller. Taller and covered with fresh blood.
She's everything the legends say she is and more.
Does Adamant know she's working for you?
No, not yet. We're saving that for a surprise.
Ha ha ha.
The sorcerer known as the Grey Veil huddled in a corner of the deserted church, shivering with the cold. He'd been there for several hours, gathering together what was left of his magic.
How did it all fall apart so fast?
One moment he was a force to be reckoned with, a sorcerer with hundreds of lesser minds under his command, and then suddenly his control was broken by an interfering guard. He ran for his life like a thief in the night. His slaves were free again, and now Grey Veil, a wanted man, carried a price on his head. It all seemed so simple in the beginning. Enter the election as a candidate, then possess enough people to raise an army of voters. Once on the council, all kinds of powerful men would have been vulnerable to his possession. A simple plan, so simple it seemed foolproof. He should have known something would go wrong. Something always went wrong. Vale hugged his knees to his chest and rocked back and forth on his haunches. He had no idea how the guards had found him out. It didn't really matter. He staked everything he had on one roll of the dice and had nothing left with which to start again. He'd be lucky to get out of Haven alive. He pulled his thin cloak tightly around him. He should have known it would come to this. All his life, everything he'd turned his hand to had failed him. He'd been born into a debt-ridden family, which, as time went by, only slid further and further into poverty. He was put to work as soon as he was able, at the age of 7. He spent his childhood in the sweatshops of the Devil's Hook, and in his adolescence moved restlessly from one lousy job to another, searching always for the one lucky break that would change his life. Whatever money he made went to plans and schemes and desperate gambles, but none of them ever came to anything. Even the girl he loved went to another man. Then he met the old man, who found in Vale a gift for magic. Vale worked himself to exhaustion to pay for the old man's lessons in sorcery, and when that wasn't enough, he stole what he needed from his friends. When he was powerful enough, he killed the old man and took his grimoires and objects of power. He became the Grey Veil and swore an oath on his own blood that whatever happened, whatever he had to do, he would never be poor again.
Oh, I should have known better. A loser is still a loser no matter what fancy new name I take.
He breathed heavily on his hands, trying to coax some warmth into his numb fingers. It was very cold in the Temple of the Abomination. There were many abandoned churches on the Street of Gods. A being's power would wane, or its followers prove fickle, or perhaps simply the fashion would change, and overnight, a church whose walls had once rung to the sound of hymns of adoration and the dropping of coins into offertory bowls would find itself suddenly deserted, abandoned. Eventually, another congregation would take over the building, worshipping another god, and business would go on as usual. But some abandoned churches were left strictly alone for fear of what might linger in the silence. For centuries, the Temple of the Abomination remained empty and alone. A small, simple, square stone building on the lower end of the Street of Gods. It looked more like a downmarket mausoleum than a church. It had no windows and only one door, no lock or bolt. The Temple of the Abomination suffered a bad reputation even for the Street of Gods. People who went in tended not to come out again. Vale didn't care. He needed a place to hide where no one else would think to look. Nothing else mattered. It slowly occurred to him that the church didn't seem as dark as it had been. When he first crept inside the church, he pulled the door shut behind him, closing out the light. The pitch darkness felt like a comfort to him then. An endless night hiding him from prying eyes. But now he could clearly make out the interior of the church, such as it was. There wasn't much to see, just plain stone walls and a broken stone altar set roughly in the center of the room. Vale frowned.
Where the hell is that light coming from?
Curiosity finally stirred him from his hiding place in the corner, and he rose slowly to his feet. He moved forward. Vale winced as his stiff joints creaked in protest. The small sounds of his footsteps seemed very loud in the quiet. Outside, on the Street of Gods, the clamor of 100 priests filled the air from dawn to dusk, augmented by the hymns and howls of the faithful. But not a whisper of that turmoil passed through the thick stone walls. Vale peered about him, but there seemed no obvious source to the dim blue light now filling the church. He glanced down at his feet to see which way his shadow was pointing, and his heart missed a beat. He didn't have a shadow. A cold hand clutched at his heart. There had to be a shadow. There were other shadows all around him. Some of them were moving. Vale stumbled back a step and looked quickly about him, but there was nothing and no one in the church with him. The quiet remained unbroken.
This is no time to be letting my imagination get the better of me. The light is nothing to worry about. There are bound to be stray vestiges of magic in a place like this.
He made himself walk over to the stone altar. It didn't look like much up close, just a great slab of stone, roughly the shape and size of an average coffin. He winced mentally at the comparison and walked slowly around the altar. It was cracked from end to end, and someone had cut runes of power into the stone with a chisel. Vale's lips moved slowly as he worked out the meaning. The runes were part of a restraining spell meant to hold something in the stone. He frowned. All he knew about the Temple of the Abomination was what everybody knew. Hundreds of years ago, when the city was still young, a cult of death and worse than death flourished on the Street of Gods. The cult held sway until the other beings joined together to destroy the Abomination and all its worshippers. It all happened so long ago that no one even remembered what the Abomination was anymore. On an impulse, Vale placed his hands on the altar and called up his magic, trying to draw out whatever impressions still remained in the stone.
Arise unto me.
Power rushed through him like a tidal wave, awful and magnificent, blinding and deafening him with its intensity. He staggered drunkenly back and forth as strange thoughts and feelings swept through him, none of them his own. Memories of priests and carriers swept through him and were gone, blazing up and disappearing like so many candles snuffed by an unforgiving darkness. There were too many to count, but all of them had served the Abomination, and it had granted them power over the earth and everything that moved upon it. Vale slowly lifted his head and looked about him. The church was lit as bright as day. He could feel the power surging within him, impatient to be released. He would use that power to gather followers and bring them to what moved within him. And the thing that men had once called the Abomination would thrive and grow again. That was not its true name, of course. Vale knew what the Abomination really was. He'd known it all his life. Hawk and Fisher lounged around Adamant's study, waiting impatiently for him to make an appearance. They were due to go campaigning in the streets soon, but Adamant promised them a chance to talk with everyone first. Hawk and Fisher still thought of themselves primarily as bodyguards, but there was still the problem of a possible traitor and embezzler somewhere in Adamant's inner circle. Hawk was determined to get to the bottom of that. He didn't like traitors. Fisher poured herself a large drink from one of the decanters and looked inquiringly at Hawk. He shook his head.
You shouldn't either, Isabel. We're going to need clear heads to get through today.
Fisher shrugged and poured half the drink back into the decanter.
Where the hell is Adamant anyway? He promised us at least an hour for these interviews.
We'll manage. Maybe we should start with someone else. Adamant's got a lot on his mind right now.
You like him, don't you?
Yes. He reminds me a lot of Blackstone. Bright, compassionate, and committed to his cause. I'm not going to lose him as well, Isabel.
Don't get carried away. Remember, as guards, we're strictly neutral. We don't take sides. We're protecting the man, not his cause. If you want to get enthusiastic about reform, do it on your own time.
Oh, come on, Isabel. Doesn't Adamant stir your blood even a little? Think of the things he could do once he gets elected.
If he gets elected.
Adamant nodded briskly to the two guards and pretended not to notice the drink in Fisher's hand.
Sorry I'm late, but Medley keeps coming up with problems he insists only I can deal with. Now, what can I do for you?
We need more detail on the death threats, the information leaks, and the embezzlement. Let's start with the death threats.
Adamant closed the door, walked to his desk, and sat on the front edge, frowning thoughtfully.
I didn't pay them much attention at first. There are always threats and crank letters. Reform has many enemies. But then the threats became specific. They said my garden would die, and it did. More magical attacks followed, including the one that killed Mortis. The last communication said I would die if I didn't resign. Blunt as that. There's not much I can tell you about the embezzling. My accountants stumbled across it quite by accident. Medley has the details. They've agreed to keep quiet about it until we can find the traitor. But they won't stay silent for long. They work for the cause, not me personally.
The information leaks?
After the embezzlement, I started checking through my records. And I found that what I'd thought of as nothing more than a run of really bad luck was actually something more than that. Something more sinister. Someone had been tipping off the Conservatives about my plans and movements. Crowds were dispersed before I could address them. Potential allies were intimidated, and meetings were disrupted by planted thugs. Not everyone has access to that kind of information in advance. It has to be someone close to me.
Assuming we identify the traitor, what if it turns out to be someone very close to you?
You let the law take its course.
Even if it's a friend?
Especially if it's a friend.